From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Martin Scorsese talks about directing his new movie, Gangs of New York. Last week, he won a Golden Globe for directing the film. It's set in Lower Manhattan in the 19th century immigrant neighborhood known as Five Points, which became the world's most notorious slum, famous for its poverty, filthy tenements, prostitution, and violence. Later, we'll hear the history of the neighborhood from historian Tyler Ambinder, author of the book Five Points. Gangs of New York coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. After hearing a report from the chief UN weapons inspectors trying to disarm Iraq, the UN Security Council is considering how to proceed. The inspectors told the council that Iraq has complied with UN demands on disarmament in some ways, but not in others. NPR's Vicki O'Hara reports.
The mixed report on Iraq's performance threatens fragile Security Council unity on how to disarm Saddam Hussein's government. The United States says it's obvious that Iraq has no intention to comply fully with the UN and that it's time to decide what to do about it. But other permanent members of the council say the inspectors should be allowed to continue their work. Ambassador Sergei Lavrov expressed the view of Russia, but it also is the view of France and China.
Inspectors are doing a very useful job, and they must continue in order for all of us to be sure that WMD programs in Iraq have indeed been stopped.
Even Britain, the United States' most determined ally in the effort to disarm Iraq, says it's willing to give inspections a few more weeks. Vicki O'Hara, NPR News, New York.
Trial began today for a retired Air Force Master Sergeant who's accused of offering to spy for Iraq, Libya, and China. Prosecutors in Alexandria, Virginia, say that Brian Regan sent a letter to Saddam Hussein offering to provide him with secret information for $13 million. The defense says Regan was guilty of bad judgment, but that he had no classified information to provide. Regan faces three counts of attempted espionage and one of illegally gathering national security information. If he's convicted, he could be subject to the death penalty. The CIA says it's received a strong response to its recruitment ads seeking new agents with Arabic language skills. The Detroit area is among the cities being targeted. Quinn Kleinfelter reports from member station WDET.
During the past week, the CIA began running advertisements in newspapers like the Detroit News and Free Press, the New York Times, and the Washington Post, seeking American citizens fluent in speaking or writing in Arabic. And CIA spokespersons say they have received about three times the normal amount of resumes from people with those skills hoping to join the agency. Government officials want to recruit Arab Americans to both gather intelligence and help analyze information. It marks the first time the spy agency has specifically recruited Arab Americans, and some leaders in the Detroit region, which boasts one of the largest Arab populations outside of the Middle East, praise the effort for giving Arab Americans a chance to participate in safeguarding the U.S. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials lost 141 points, or 1.7%, to close at 7,989 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq lost 17 points, or 1.2%. It closed at 1,325. This is NPR News. Sales of single-family homes ended the year on a strong note. The National Association of Realtors says for December, sales of existing houses were up 5.2%. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
Through what has been a stormy economic recovery, the nation's housing market has shone like a beacon. The National Association of Realtors, the industry's main trade group, reports a surge in home sales during the final month of last year. The group says sales of existing homes rose to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of nearly 5.9 million units. For all of last year, sales of existing homes set a record, and it's expected when final numbers on housing are in, they'll show sales of new homes were also at record levels last year. New home construction last month posted its biggest rise in 16 years. Much of the large increase in sales of both new and existing homes was due to the fact mortgage interest rates have stayed so low, hovering around 6%, or in some instances, even lower for much of last year. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
A Florida judge has overturned a jury verdict against the company that distributed the gun used in the murder of a middle school teacher. The verdict came in a lawsuit brought by Pam Grunow, whose husband Barry was shot to death by one of his students, Nathaniel Brazil, in May of 2000. Grunow said that Valor Corporation was negligent for not providing its guns with a lock or other device that could have prevented an unauthorized person, such as Brazil, from using it. The jury agreed and awarded $1.2 million to the widow. The judge threw out that verdict today, saying that the jury did not find that the gun Valor distributed was defective, so the company couldn't be held liable for the way it was used. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America, on the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Martin Scorsese, grew up in Manhattan's Little Italy, a few blocks from the neighborhood that was once called Five Points, the place where his new movie Gangs of New York is set. A little later, we'll hear from historian Tyler Anbinder, who has written a history of Five Points, the 19th century neighborhood of immigrants, which became famous for its abject poverty, filthy tenements, garbage-covered streets, prostitution, and violence. Scorsese first started working on Gangs of New York in 1978. Last week, he won a Golden Globe for Best Director. His film, Gangs of New York, focuses on the conflict between two gangs in Five Points, the Irish and the nativists. The nativists were Anglo-Saxons who were born in New York and thought the new immigrants were polluting it. Leonardo DiCaprio is one of the leaders of the Irish gang. Daniel Day-Lewis plays the leader of the nativists. He killed DiCaprio's father. DiCaprio grows up in reform school. In this scene, he's just been released and has returned to Five Points. His friend, played by Henry Thomas, is filling him in on the latest developments there.
You got the Daybreak Boys and the Swamp Angels. They work the river looting ships. The Frog Hollow Shanghai sailors down around the Bloody Angle. Shirttails was rough for a while, but they become a bunch of jack-rolling dandies, lolling around Murderer's Alley looking like Chinamen. Hellcat Maggie, she tried to open her own grog shop. But she drunk up all her own liquor and got thrown out on the street.
Beautiful.
Now she's on the lay for anything. There's a plug uglies. They're from somewhere deep in the old country. Got their own language. No one understands what they're saying. They love to fight the cops. And the night walkers, the rat pickers, rogue. They work on their backs and kill with their hands. They're so scurvy under the plug uglies to talk to them. But who knows what they're saying? The slaughterhousers and the Broadway twisters. They're a fine bunch of bingo boys. And the little 40 thieves. I used to run with them for a while. Till they got took over by Benjer the cockroach and his red-eyed buggers. Benjer carries a germ. If you try to leave the gang, they say he hacks up blood on you.
I asked Martin Scorsese to share some of his impressions of Five Points.
The area of the Five Points really reflected the breakdown of civilization, that many tried to keep a family together, but many of them were not given jobs, and they would just disintegrate, so to speak. The family would disintegrate into drunkenness and all kinds of terrible situations that occurred down there. That place was maybe 40,000 people living in a very small area, sort of like the Wild West in a way, except that instead of wide open spaces, you've got everything somewhat claustrophobic around, you know, everybody crowded around each other and on top of each other. So what I'm getting at is that besides the sense of Irish-American, the Irish family, there's something even more primal, which is, first of all, survival. And once that person gets some food and then feeds the family, the next thing is shelter, and the next thing is gathering with other families to form a tribe. And this is what I was going for. It was almost like a post-apocalyptic world where people had to redefine what living really is, let alone get into politics, not even get into that area.
The opening scene in Gangs of New York is a battle scene in 1846 between Irish immigrants and the men calling themselves natives because they were born in America. Liam Neeson leads the Irish gang. Daniel Day-Lewis leads the natives. We first see the Irish gang getting ready for this battle in this enormous underground, like a huge tunnel.
Yes.
What is this tunnel?
Well, the thing is, let me put it this way. The film is not a historical documentary.
Right.
The idea was, if the film's an opera. People who are quibbling about whether a cave existed, and I'm telling you that you tell me, you can argue me in terms of people have argued me about it. Well, was there a cave? Was it? Yes, there are caves. Have you ever gone down to the tenement to turn when the fuse goes off on Elizabeth Street in 1955 when the fuses went out and you had to go down the basement to put a new fuse in? First of all, you had to be armed because of the rats. You found below there were more. I think what they did, you see, I know that the Italians used the sub-basements, not just the basement, the sub-basements for storage, but mainly for making wine, which was very important. I do know, and I actually saw it happen, that some basements have so many secret ways. Mm-hmm. A person who is a thief, let's say, or somebody's chasing him or her, go into a basement on Mulberry Street and come out on Elizabeth somehow, or come out in the backyards down by the church. This was all done for protection, and I think very importantly, the idea was to at times make the film feel as if you were witnessing a sort of fever dream that these people come right from the bowels of the earth, that they represent every group that's ever been oppressed and every group that's ever been part of the dispossessed.
I think you're also saying you're a long-time Manhattan resident and you can't imagine New York without undergrounds of various sorts.
the sewer system,
the subway, the basements.
The sewers alone. I don't even,
yeah.
I can't even get into what that must look like down there. And I've been below. And I mean, go to the Chinese area. I tell you now that there are places below the ground where people are working. Way below the ground.
Well, this opening fight sequence is kind of amazing. It looks almost medieval because, you know, people are, I don't know, partially because of how they're dressed and how it's shot.
Yes, well, they have to scare the other person that's, you know, basically screaming, and they're wearing fearsome makeup and body paint and all sorts of things that anybody does. They still do today in battle.
And they're fighting with knives and with cleavers. And in this fight sequence, particularly like Daniel Day-Lewis, who plays a butcher and a gang leader, he's walking around with this huge cleaver just kind of hacking away at people's legs.
Absolutely,
It's gruesome. And I'm remembering back to a previous interview that you recorded on Fresh Air.
But we didn't say it was graphic, though.
No, but I'm interested in why you wanted to make it not graphic.
Yeah, because I made so many films over the years that deal with violence in a pretty flat, straightforward way.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't know how else to do it except the way I did it in Mean Streets and Taxi Driver and Goodfellas and Casino. But by the end of Casino, the killing of Joe Pesci and his brother and a string of killings in Las Vegas, I think it's very important to depict this lifestyle, and you have to show the downside, and this is the downside of it. And you have to be honest with it. I just think you have to be honest in the portrayal of violence and not glorify it, but just put yourself in that position and to understand the brutality of it, and the particularly the killing, let's say, of Pesci and his brother at that point by his best friends, simply with bats. It was with baseball bats. The brutality is primeval, you know. And I think I don't want to make it stylish anymore, but I didn't want to fall into a cause and effect of a violent movement, and you see the effect graphically. I wanted to suggest it with camera moves, camera speed, 48 frames, 64 frames, 12 frames, speeding up and down, going, starting a shot of 48, going to 12, then going to 24, back and forth, reverse it, that sort of stuff. And also through sound effects, but very little sound effects. So that I wanted to stylize, particularly the opening battle scene based on, of course, you know, there's Orson Welles is the best battle scene ever in a film, Chimes of Midnight. And films I really, really like. I just enjoy watching Russian cinema of the 1920s, Budovkin, mm-hmm. particularly Eisenstein,
mm-hmm.
Dashenko, and a number of others. And so there was one instance in Potemkin that I saw that was interesting. Again, I naturally, everybody knows Potemkin, and particularly the Odessa step sequence. But I always remember the scene where a sailor is washing dishes, and it says, he comes to a dish, it says, "Give us this day our daily bread" on the dish. And he had just had, the scene before had shown that they were feeding the sailors rotten meat, and the sailors were about to mutiny because of this. And he was washing this dish, he's wearing a striped T-shirt, and he just looks at the dish, and it cuts back to his face, looks at the dish, and then he smashes the dish. And I think there's maybe, in the smashing of the dish, there's maybe 12 cuts. But the cuts I was interested in were the cuts of his arm, elbow, having had completed the motion of the breaking of the dish, the power in his arm. But it was after the action. And so this gave me an idea about different aspects of different parts of, let me put it this way, stunt moves, battle moves. In other words, I was more interested in not necessarily showing
the knife going into the wound.
Or... Yeah, exactly. But also wasn't it that interested? I mean, basically, if it was all hand to hand combat, it should be done another way. In other words, it wasn't. There was no big surprise. The big surprise ultimately is when Bill the Butcher finally finds his way to Priest Valen. That's the surprise. Everything else, I was interested in the movement, and the creation of a kind of confused, futile, primeval world. Everything, just the futility of the fight itself. And you add to that the music that we put on, then there was a piece by Peter Gabriel called Signal to Noise, which is pretty interesting, and I think you get a sense of what I was trying.
Yeah, no, that music is pretty contemporary, and the scene takes place in 1846, but as you're saying, it looks more medieval than 19th century. So why use contemporary music?
Well, I didn't want to there's no reason to be kind of literal.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to be literal at all in the movie. Originally, back in 1979, when I wanted to make the film, but I really didn't make a serious attempt to make the film at that time, but I had envisioned The Clash doing the music, and... The three boys there at the time being in the film in some one way or another. And it was going to be even more contemporary, the music. But in this case, I don't want to make it literal at all. There are times when I do go throughout the picture, source music, in a way, is very, very accurate, as much as possible. Sometimes it may slip into blues a little too soon for the period, you know, just a little bit. I couldn't help it. But because it was happening, that was the idea. It was all coming together. So every now and then we slip in a little something. But in terms of the Gabriel piece at that point, it's more like a dirge, more like an elegy in a way, the scene rather than a battle scene.
My guest is Martin Scorsese. We're talking about his new film, Gangs of New York. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Martin Scorsese, and we're talking about his new movie, Gangs of New York. Now, in addition to that opening fight sequence that we're talking about, there's a long and fascinating series of fight sequences at the end of the film as part of the draft riots. And these are the riots after the first draft in the Union was created during the Civil War, when 25,000 men from New York City alone were going to be drafted. So there were riots throughout Manhattan. And even the military is coming in with cannons firing onto the city.
Yes.
And you're showing that. Now, it's not exactly a cast of thousands epic, you know, like Spartacus or something, but this is pretty big battle scenes. I'm reminded of when you were talking about The Last Temptation of Christ and you were complaining that it was such a cheap film.
Yeah,
you had like four extras and you had to keep moving
I
around.
The camera. It was the same four guys.
Exactly,
constantly.
Exactly. So here you are working with actually a lot of extras in these battle sequences. Are there things you had to learn how to do that you hadn't done before to choreograph these scenes?
Yeah, communicate, basically. Let them all know what you wanted, you know. But again, I had a very strong second unit director, Vic Armstrong, who really helped me a great deal. A lot of the fight scenes in the beginning of the film, and particularly the ending, at one point, these were shots that were drawn on paper, and then they were actually drawn in an edited order. Shot one would go to shot two, two to three, three to four, four shots, and I designed in such a way, and I gave those shots while I was doing other stuff because we control the whole area. You see, we had that all those sets, they were our sets, they were our little city. Vic Armstrong was able to go off and literally get me those frames. But at the end, we handled that battle scene differently, and it was a matter of the explosions in the square and ultimately the Union troops coming in and those wide shots. Which we did in a more traditional way, I think, with six or seven cameras. And then we found quickly that, although we knew it, that howitzer shells exploding in the square would hit the dust and people would just find themselves locked in some limbo of just dust and white smoke all around them. And so we utilized that to isolate Bill in Amsterdam, and that went on and on like that. So I was very much helped by Vic Armstrong and also Joe Reedy and Michael Hausman, all these people who helped put the scene together. In fact, the big fight scene at the end was the biggest shots were done only in one day.
Wow.
The detail stuff went on for a couple of weeks. That was stronger. This was the period. This was a period the Union troops did have to come in and to make it even more interesting in a way. We never was able to get this in the picture. I tried a few times, but there's so many things I had to sort of limit myself. I wanted to do so much with it. But the troops did come in from after having had won the Battle of Gettysburg. And so, you know, this was a major issue. I mean, they were hard-bitten troops, and they had just gone through hell, and it was the first major battle, I think, that began the war towards the North, and they were using howitzers in the streets.
Daniel Day-Lewis plays Bill the Butcher. He's literally a butcher, but he's metaphorically a butcher, too. He's the leader of this gang of natives, and he runs around with this cleaver. Butchering
not
people.
All the time.
Well, not all the time, but
yeah,
but enough of the time. And he seems to get a great deal of pleasure from it as well.
Yes, yes.
Anyways, it's quite a performance. The last time you directed Daniel Day-Lewis, it was in a very reserved performance in your film,
yes,
The Age of Innocence. Can you describe at all what you told him you wanted from him in this movie and how you worked with him on this performance?
Well, I think, you know, what it was that we got to know each other somewhat on Age of Innocence, and he became Newland Archer in Age of Innocence, and so we were able to talk and sort of felt a bond with him. And then, of course, you know, I had seen him in My Left Foot, and then after Age of Innocence, I saw him in The Name of the Father and films like that, of course, The Last of the Mohicans. So I knew he was capable of the other side of Newland Archer, let's say. And the key thing was to convince him to be in the film, and it was done by myself and Leo DiCaprio and Harvey Weinstein in New York. And ultimately, I think what I was really hoping for, and I think we've got, is a man of that period, a man who was so a warlord of that period, let's say. And many of these men were ex-pugilists. Most of them were ex-fighters, butchers, whatever. The butcher was looked upon by working class and the lower classes as a sort of king of merchants in a way, and so he already had some power going in as a showman. And this is what I wanted: the theater piece, the showman, the man who, as he later says, conducts, or should I put it, commits fearsome acts with a sense of theatricality and a sense of humor, a charismatic leader. And this is what I wanted. And I knew that he would be able to find that. Although with him, he had pointed out last week we were talking, he pointed out that usually the character has to find him, has to let himself be known to him. And so he just becomes, after about 2 or 3 weeks, you find that whatever moves he's making, suggestions for an improv or something, is coming from the character who's now sort of permeating his being in a way. So when he talks to you, when he talked to me, like off camera or just even on the telephone, is no longer as Daniel, and it's not some magical process. It's just it just happens to be the way he goes through it. And
when he starts talking to you as Bill the Butcher,
constantly. So even if it's a telephone on the holidays at dinner, and sometimes would make comments, particularly when he was in costume and off camera, he was definitely Bill, and comment about the. Of course, you know Daniel's Irish, but he would comment about the Irish, make comments about them on the set, stir up trouble that way to keep the energy going.
How do you respond to that, though, when you know somebody's talking to you in persona, and it's, in fact, you created? It's easier?
Oh, much easier.
Much easier.
You're dealing with the real thing. You're just going, okay, Bill, what do you think of this? Well, if you did that to me, I would have to do this. I see. True. But what if you went this way? And, I mean, it goes on. It goes back and forth. It's actually cutting out a middleman. It was cutting out Daniel. It was just going straight
funny.
To Bill. It was fine with me.
Yeah, but what if he starts talking to you about, like, the weather as Bill the Butcher, or, you know...
That's what he did.
Yeah?
Yeah. That's okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anybody else you've worked with do that?
A couple of people, yeah. To a certain extent. I don't think as much as I encountered with Newland and Bill, let me put it that way.
Mm-hmm. And his accent, where does that come from?
Well, we started working on the accents. Tim Monick, as our dialect coach from Age of Innocence on all my movies. And Tim got together with me, and we did some research with Daniel. And one of the first things he found was, of course, there's no recordings or there's a lot written in colloquial New Yorkese, so to speak, of these plays in the Bowery about the Bowery boys in the 1840s and 1850s, 1860s. There's a lot on the written page. We see the way the words are written. Boyos is B-H-O-O-Y-S or something, or I may be wrong about that, but Gallus Mag and the names and the names of the people, and of course the jargon, or I should say they really had their own language. It was called the Rogues. It was written up in 1859 by an ex police chief into a collection called the Rogues Lexicon, and we use a lot of those words in the film. Mm-hmm. And in some cases we could have done more, but it was almost you'd have to have subtitles.
Yeah.
And so what Tim Monick first discussed was listening to a recording of Walt Whitman, the only recording of Walt Whitman, I believe, reciting four lines from one of his poems about New York. And one of the phrases was the ample streets of New York, if I'm not mistaken. But I know the word ample was in there. We say ample. Whitman said ample, apparently, on the wax disc cylinder, and which made a flat A. Then I remember Louis Auchincloss talking to me after Age of Innocence and talking about Mrs. Mingott character, who was based on Mrs. Jones, the original Mrs. Jones. And he said that they spoke in an odd way, he said, at times. He said, for example, Mrs. Jones would have said to her children, don't forget to take your poils, goyles. So then you got poils, goyles, ample. And it's suddenly becoming like New York cabbies in the 30s, 40s, and 50s.
Exactly,
you know?
Yeah.
The Bowery boys, you know. And so we went with that. And he started writing. I mean, he started reading. Daniel started reading the Bible aloud. Working with an accent that way with Tim. So we created our accent based on what was written.
We'll talk more with Martin Scorsese about Gangs of New York in the second half of the show. Here's Daniel Day-Lewis as Bill the Butcher. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
You know how I stayed alive this long? All these years. Fear. The spectacle of fearsome acts. Somebody steals from me, I cut off his hands. He offends me, I cut out his tongue. He rises against me, I cut off his head, stick it on a pike. Raise it high up so all on the streets can see. That's what preserves the order of things.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Harcourt, publisher of The Crimson Petal and the White, a novel of Victorian England by Michelle Faber. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the history behind Gangs of New York. We talk with Tyler Anbinder, author of 5 Points, the 19th century New York City neighborhood that invented tap dance, stole elections, and became the world's most notorious slum. And we continue our interview with Martin Scorsese.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Martin Scorsese. We're talking about his new film, Gangs of New York, which is set in Five Points, the notorious 19th century slum in Lower Manhattan. Last week, Scorsese won a Golden Globe for directing the film. It's not giving away anything about the story to say that at the end of the film kind of dissolves and we see a modern New York skyline. We see a couple of New York skylines as they evolve. And in the final skyline, the World Trade Center is in it.
Yes.
So that's the final image that we see. Did you think of adding a post-September 11th, post-World Trade Center skyline?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, from way back in that very first draft, Jay Cox's draft in 78, 79, that was the way it ended. We knew that we were diehard New Yorkers, and it had to end with the skyline being built. It just had to. In fact, we had a second part of the story that we wanted to do, which was the building of the Brooklyn Bridge and how the bridge linked Manhattan to the rest of the country or vice versa. And so it had to end with that. We just couldn't resist it. The thing about it, of course, that was that we did that painting series of dissolves and paintings before September 11th. And right after it, I thought about it. And, you know, we're making a film. I felt that taking out the towers was not the right way to go. I thought we should leave them in. The people in the film, good, bad, or indifferent, were part of the creation of that skyline, not the destruction of it. And if the skyline collapses, ultimately we're aware of the struggle of humanity, if there's any left, building up another one. I think this is the sense of time going by, the sense of civilization changing, and primarily the idea of the city that we know now coming out of this extraordinary struggle, which not many people really know about. And so I felt it would have been right to go in and keep revising New York skyline in movies, erasing the two towers. That was the way I left it.
You know, it's so interesting. Gangs of New York is about learning about the past of Manhattan, your home. And then as you're making the movie, September 11th happens and Manhattan gets transformed in a horrible and shocking and totally unpredictable way. So your feelings about Manhattan must just be so deep right now.
It's just part of me. And I think, you know, so much of it, I think probably was even stronger because I spent the first 6 years of my life in Queens. And when we were catapulted back onto Elizabeth Street, the tenements where my mother and father were born, not in hospitals, but in the tenements, with that whole, all that life in the street, which at first terrifying, and then sort of found my way to survive in it, it was such a strong impression. There were so many cultures thrown together, so many religions, so fascinating, so many, just the cuisine alone, the different cuisines, just being near the Chinese was fascinating. So this is, the city for me is the center of the world that way. In the film, it represents, New York City represents a city that, according to a lot of historians, felt that in the 19th century, if democracy didn't work in New York, it wasn't going to work in the rest of the country.
One last quick question. There's been, you know, news coverage of the fact that your initial edit of Gangs of New York was much longer,
yeah.
And there was a tussle with Miramax.
Yeah. I got news for you. Every film I made, the first edit is longer.
Right.
Isn't that something?
Right.
I don't know. Are you going to edit this program?
Yes.
Because if you edit it, you're ruining the original version.
I hear you.
There's no doubt there's no doubt Harvey and I fighting all the time. It's just the nature of our personalities and the nature of a big movie where they have a certain amount of money and I wanted more. It goes, goes on and on and on like that.
Right.
And then the nature of the cutting of the film, I kept a track of every screening and how long the film was. Normally, Thelma Schoonmaker and myself screened the picture 8-9 times.
Maybe. She's your editor, yeah.
Yes, Thelma Schoonmaker, and she's been editing everything with me since Raging Bull, 1980. And some films go a little faster, bigger films go a little longer. And we kept revising and working on the picture, writing dialogue, things like that, all the way through the editing process, which I did in Casino too. Not in Goodfellas, in Age of Innocence somewhat, and in Casino definitely. Kundun was a very, very difficult edit. That took almost a year to do. We had to revise and restructure the picture from the original script. But in a case like that, you can say, well, the original cut. Well, yeah, but we didn't think that was the movie. You see, so here we have Gangs of New York. Cut number one, I believe, was, forget the date, but it was 3 hours and 38 minutes. That was our assembly. That was everything we knew in the kitchen sink thrown in, you know. But did it work? No. So 2 days later, I recut it, and it came down to 3 hours and 37 minutes. I cut out 1 minute. So now we begin a long, arduous process in which I will have to take everybody's opinions, because I want to see where we're going. Not only the studio is going to give opinions through Harvey and other people with him, but the writers, our friends who come to see these films, we have all that listed. There were 18 screenings ultimately of the film, 18 screenings, and there's not one version that I would say that's my original version. This was all series of changes and rewrites and restructuring at times till finally, finally, it's like a giant sculpture. It's come down to the movie you see in the theater. As far as putting new scenes on the DVD, yeah, there are some scenes I cut out, but there's nothing that I think are, how should I put it, nothing that I'm really fond of, that I like, or that I thought belonged in the picture, ultimately.
Some people think they're eventually going to see your definitive director's cut. That's not going to happen.
I'm afraid not. Sorry to disappoint everybody, because I know that I do a lot with film restoration and film preservation, and there were director's cuts of Sam Peckinpah's Wild Bunch and Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid and films like that, and they finally were saved. Those are still around. There are director's cuts of the famous Greed by Erwin Stroheim and so many other films, and they're gone, destroyed. But in this case, on the DVD, we'll have plenty of featurettes and ways. I might show some alternate takes, how the actors were improvising. That might be interesting. But ultimately, I really feel there's nothing special really regret not going in the picture and not staying in the film. I mean, and you could think another way, and that is we should have had another 30 pages of scenes and shot another 25 days or 30 days and made the film an hour longer, but we didn't have them.
Right.
So, you know, it would have been like the old, old spectaculars where you had an intermission in the middle, you know, everything. I would have liked, but in this way, I just found that there's certain things I must say I found that were slow and ponderous and repetitious, and I said, let's move.
Martin Scorsese, thank you so much for with us.
Thank you.
Martin Scorsese's new film is Gangs of New York. He'll receive a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Directors Guild of America March 1st. Coming up, we talk with historian Tyler Anbinder about his book, 5 Points, about the 19th century slum in which Gangs of New York is set. This is Fresh Air. The film Gangs of New York is based on a 1928 book of the same name by Herbert Asbury. It's been republished and is currently on the bestseller list. Historian Tyler Anbinder says many of the most sensational stories in the book are based on the unreliable press coverage of the time and aren't true. Anbinder is the author of the book 5 Points, the 19th century New York City neighborhood that invented tap dance, stole elections, and became the world's most notorious slum. Anbinder is an associate professor of history at George Washington University. He consulted with Martin Scorsese on the screenplay of Gangs of New York. 5 Points was located about a half mile north of the Brooklyn Bridge. The area is now the lower part of Chinatown, just south of Canal Street, at the foot of the Bowery. I asked Tyler Anbinder what made 5 Points notorious.
Living conditions for the predominantly immigrants who lived in the neighborhood were as bad as anywhere in the United States and perhaps anywhere in the Western world. The neighborhood had been built over what had been a lake in the south central part of Manhattan. They filled over the lake, but they didn't do a very good job of it, and so the buildings they built over the lake began to sag and droop almost immediately. As a result, the wind in the winter poured in, and so it was very cold. And the immigrants who were coming to 5 Points were the poorest of the poor immigrants coming to the United States, people who literally could afford to go no farther once the boat dropped them off in New York. And so these tenements were terribly overcrowded. And once they became overcrowded, the sanitary conditions in the tenements became really horrendous. You had outhouses in the backyards that overflowed, and people who got terrible diseases like cholera as a result of those poor sanitary conditions.
In Martin Scorsese's film, Gangs of New York, the conflict revolves around the Irish immigrants and the group known as the Natives, which are American-born people of Protestant Anglo-Saxon descent who hate all the new immigrants coming in, thinking the new immigrants are ruining New York and ruining America. Was that a real conflict that was going on in Five Points?
Not so much in Five Points. You've got a neighborhood that's, in terms of adult population, 80 or 90% immigrant. And so a nativist gang is going to get pummeled in Five Points. And so the idea that's portrayed in the movie that there's this nativist gang led by Daniel Day-Lewis that controls Five Points could never have happened because simply the Irish were too numerous in Five Points. So the nativists were going to be in other parts of the city, were rarely going to show their faces in Five Points because they knew they would not be welcome there.
So the butcher character played by Daniel Day-Lewis, there's no historical person who that character is based on?
Oh, no, that is the Bill the Butcher character is based on really two people. The one he's named after was a real New York City politician named Bill the Butcher Poole, who had started as a butcher. He was not a nativist gang leader. He was a Whig politician, a member of the Whig Party, uptown, not down in Five Points, and became famous really overnight because he had gotten into a fight with an Irish-American politician. And that politician's friends then came and shot Poole. And Poole supposedly said, as he lay dying on this saloon floor on Broadway, "Goodbye, boys, I die a true American." And the movie has Daniel Day-Lewis saying that when he's killed at the end of the movie. The other character that the Daniel Day-Lewis figure is based on is a guy named Isaiah Rinders. And actually, more of what's portrayed in the movie matches this fellow Rinders. He was a gang leader more so than Bill Poole was. He had a gang made up mostly of ex-prize fighters, bare-knuckle prize fighters, who he would lead to the polls to intimidate people from voting for Rinder's opponents. And that was very much a common thing in the 19th century. If you wanted to win an election, you put muscle at the polls to stop people from voting for your opponents. And Rinders actually did try to go to Five Points and try to take over Five Points politics. And he brought his gang with him. The Irish came. This was at a primary meeting. And the Irish came and opposed him. And they had a big brawl. And in the end, the Irish had won. And Rinders was kicked out of the neighborhood. And that was the end of it. So Scorsese has taken those two stories, the one of Poole and the one of Rinders, that are both told in the Asbury book Gangs of New York, and made those into the character of Bill Cutting in the movie.
Let's talk a little bit more about what life in Five Points must have been like. You write about one building called the Old Brewery, which you describe as the most repulsive building of its day, a vast dark cave, a black hole into which every urban nightmare and unspeakable fear could be projected.
The Old Brewery was, as the name implies, once a brewery, sitting on the shores of the old collect pond, using the water from there to make the beer. It was closed down and converted eventually into a tenement. And it was particularly notorious, first, because it was a huge building, an industrial building. And when they subdivided it, many of the apartments had no windows at all. And so, of course, there aren't too many people who are going to voluntarily live in an apartment with no windows and no light. So only the poorest of the poor residents of Five Points lived there, the most desperate people, the people with hardly any money. And as a result, conditions there became quite terrible. The darkness, disease was rampant there because of the lack of ventilation, the lack of proper sanitary facilities, because you've got this huge building with hundreds of inhabitants and not nearly the outhouse facilities to accommodate them. It was a favorite hideout for thieves from the neighborhood who would run in there, hide there, loot from the police for a later time. So because of the crime, because of the destitution, because of the overcrowding, the Old Brewery became the most notorious tenement probably that New York ever had.
In Gangs of New York, fighting and brutality become sport and entertainment. I mean, you see this in theaters as well as on the street. What was entertainment like in Five Points?
Fighting was definitely a form of entertainment in 19th century New York. You have bare-knuckle prize fighting, not done in the city itself because it's illegal, not done on a barge as is portrayed in the movie either, but you'd go to a rural place like Staten Island or some other place where these fights would be held. But you did have sparring in bars as a spectacle. People would come to these bars to see the sparring that went on. There were all sorts of favorite modes of entertainment in Five Points. In particular, dancing was a favorite. The neighborhood was famous for its dance halls. These tended to be basement dance halls, tiny places by modern standards. You know, a room maybe 25 feet wide and at most 50 feet long. And that had to include, of course, chairs and a bar as well, and a tiny dance floor. And you'd have a fiddler in the corner, maybe with someone playing a tambourine as well, or a harmonica, and people would dance. And in fact, it appears that it was in these Five Points dance halls that tap dancing was invented, as the Irish came to the neighborhood bringing their native dances, such as the jig, those kind of high-stepping dances. They met the neighborhood's African-American inhabitants whose dances included things like the shuffle. And it's said that in these competitions, friendly competitions, it developed amongst the five-pointers that tap dancing is invented.
Gangs of New York climaxes with the draft riots of 1863. What set off these riots?
The draft riots were set off by a number of things. First, New Yorkers had never really accepted the idea of going to war against the South. The New York economy was very much tied to the Southern economy. Much of the cotton that was produced in the South came through New York on its way to the mills of New England or Europe. New Yorkers saw their economy very much as linked to that of the South through its financing, through the merchants who handled the cotton and so forth. So New Yorkers were not that thrilled to have to go to war to fight the South in the first place. That became even more so when Lincoln, in the middle of 1862, announced the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation that, beginning in 1863, if the South did not give up, that the slaves would be freed. And that turned the war from a war to save the Union into a war to end slavery. And New Yorkers were especially not interested in fighting a war to end slavery. Most New Yorkers did not see slavery as such a terrible institution, and were not willing to lay down their lives to end it. Then finally, in mid-1863, the Lincoln administration decided that because volunteering for the army was declining, that a draft was necessary. Both the South and the North instituted a draft in the middle of the war. And so now, for the first time, Americans might have to fight against their will, might be dragged into the contest even if they objected to it. Part of the draft law said that if you could pay $300, a drafted person could be exempted from the war. And five-pointers and poor New Yorkers in general hated that aspect of the draft law. They thought that turned the war into a poor man's fight and allowed the well-to-do to stay out of harm's way. So all those factors combined to cause this terrible outbreak of violence when the draft begins in July of 1863.
So who rioted and what were their targets?
The rioters were predominantly Irish-American New Yorkers who saw themselves as the target of the draft law and those who would be unfairly singled out to serve in the army. Their targets were really everything that they saw as representations of the Republican Party. So they attacked the homes of famous Republicans. They attacked the newspaper offices of those newspapers that supported the Lincoln administration, and especially those that supported emancipation. And they attacked New York City's African-American population, pretty much attacking blacks anywhere they found them all over the city, lynching many, burning down the city's black orphan asylum. And so blacks in particular and symbols of Republican power in general were the targets of the mob's rage.
Military troops were called in to put down the riot. When were they called in?
After about the second day of rioting, when it became clear that this was not just a typical New York riot, troops were called in. And the Army decided to send soldiers who had just been fighting at Gettysburg days before, send them north to New York to help put down the civil unrest there. And it was only after 4 or 5 days that finally the city calmed down again.
So were there a lot of Irishmen from Five Points who were participating in these draft riots, and was Five Points torn apart as the result of the riots?
Five Pointers were not particularly active in the draft riots. We know from looking at the arrest records that not a large number of Five Pointers took place in the most serious fighting. Most of the fighting during the draft riots took place uptown. And it was mostly participated in by people who lived uptown. So no, Five Pointers weren't terribly involved in the most outrageous acts of violence during the fighting. On the other hand, Five Points itself, like almost every neighborhood of New York, was very much torn apart by the rioting, because you have in the neighborhood during the riot, many of the neighborhood's black residents are attacked, probably by Five Pointers, or at least with the certainly there's got to be some help of the whites in the neighborhood to point out which buildings the blacks lived in, because what the rioters tended to do was find out which buildings housed blacks and then attack those buildings, try to burn those buildings down. So there was terrible violence against Five Points African-American population during the rioting, even though Five Points isn't usually thought of as the place where the riots took place.
My guest is historian Tyler Anbinder, author of the book Five Points. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Tyler Anbinder, is the author of the book Five Points, a history of the notorious 19th century slum in Lower Manhattan. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's new film, Gangs of New York. During the mid-1800s, when Gangs of New York is set, which groups were represented in the immigrant population of Five Points?
The neighborhood was overwhelmingly Irish. About two-thirds of the neighborhood's inhabitants were Irish immigrants or their young children. But the neighborhood had other immigrants as well. It had a significant number, probably about 15% of the population were German immigrants. There were also significant numbers even at this point of East European Jewish immigrants, especially from Poland, living in Five Points. But it was predominantly an Irish neighborhood, and it was known overwhelmingly as an Irish enclave.
The Irish were despised by a lot of Americans when they came here because they were seen as, you know, the poor immigrants who were coming in with their own culture, bringing poverty, and what else? What were the other reasons why the Irish became so despised as an early immigrant group to the United States?
Part of it definitely has to do with the poverty. Widespread poverty was something simply virtually unknown in America before the 1830s. And so after especially the potato famine in the mid-1840s, and you have tens and hundreds of thousands of completely destitute people arriving in America, many native-born Americans resented the fact that now you have widespread poverty, that crime increases as a result, that this overcrowding of tenements takes place. And that very much worried Americans, even who didn't live in neighborhoods like Five Points, because diseases like cholera that could easily spread throughout a whole city and you know, during various outbreaks in the early 19th century killed tens of thousands of people in cities like New York and Philadelphia. Cholera could spread from a poor neighborhood like Five Points to a well-to-do neighborhood. And so for all those reasons, immigrants' presence was resented. The other very important factor, though, one that's hard to appreciate today, is that Americans thought of the United States as a Protestant nation. They thought Protestantism was what made America great. So seeing so many Catholics coming to the United States really made them fear that the very fabric of the nation was going to change, that the Protestant values that they thought had made America so economically prosperous and so free, that these things were all threatened by Catholics, especially because Catholics were stereotyped in this time to be people who pretty much followed whatever they were told by their priests and their bishops. And so they were thought that they could very much change American politics by creating a voting bloc that could be controlled by a single individual or a set of Catholic leaders.
What would you say is the legacy of Five Points?
One legacy of Five Points is that Five Points, in a way, taught Americans how to deal with poverty. It was in Five Points that many of the things we take for granted today, substance abuse, job training, child care, things that we now accept as the most important facets of helping people get out of poverty, these were things that were tried for the first time in Five Points, because Five Points poverty was so bad that the old things that Americans had done to try to deal with it just didn't work. And so these new things were tried, and many of them became standard parts of the social service system that we know today. Another legacy of Five Points is that, as the movie portrays very well, it was in places like Five Points that Americans had to learn to accept a multi-ethnic nation. In the early 19th century, the United States was overwhelmingly Protestant. And in Five Points, Americans for the first time had to deal with the fact that more people want to come to the United States than just Protestants, just English people, for example. And it was in places like Five Points that different ethnic groups, different religious groups, for the first time had to learn to get along. And it wasn't always very easy, and often there was a lot of violence, a lot of resentment. But eventually it was through places like Five Points that the multi-ethnic nation we know today was created.
Tyler Anbinder, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Tyler Anbinder is the author of the book Five Points. He's an associate professor of history at George Washington University. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Crow Lake, a novel of sibling relationships set in Northern Ontario by Mary Lawson. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, we discuss the weapons inspections in Iraq with Joseph Cirincione, the Nonproliferation Project Director for the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. The endowment has just released a new report on the inspection process titled Iraq, What Next? I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.